all those who have made its publication possible. The trustees of the Rupert Brooke Estate, Professors Andrew Motion and John Stallworthy, distinguished poets and biographers both, supported the project from the outset, and generously allowed me full access to the enormous quantity of Brooke material at the Library of King's College, Cambridge. At the archive, the librarian, Jacqueline Cox, and her staff combined cool professionalism with kindness and knowledge. In Rugby, I'm indebted to Rugby School's librarian, Rusty McLean, for allowing me access to Brooke material, and to local historian Dr. Peter Miller, a notable authority on Brooke, for his hospitality and for sharing his knowledge, in particular for an illuminating discussion of Brooke's health and final illness from the viewpoint of a professional medical man. I have drawn deeply and shamelessly on the knowledge of previous Brooke biographers, who have been generous to a fault in discussing our mutual interest. Michael Hastings gave me fascinating letters and photos, and shared his own memories of meetings with Noel Olivier, one of the loves of Brooke's life. Mike Reed likewise disclosed a generous fraction of his own vast knowledge of Brooke in many long conversations, and I am grateful also to Professor Paul Delaney for his encouragement. Dr. Keith Clements, biographer of Brooke's nemesis, Henry Lamb, was endlessly helpful and put me in touch with Lamb's daughter, Mrs. Henrietta Phipps, who, despite the ancient antipathy, was more than kind. Francis Spurling, biographer of Duncan Grant, discussed with me his relationship with Rupert Brooke, and Richard Shon, an authority on Brooke's hated Bloomsburys, kindly allowed me to reproduce a rare nude photograph of Brooke's soulmate, Carr Cox. Mr. Peter Ward discussed memories of his father, Dudley Ward, perhaps Brooke's closest friend. Anne Olivier Bell, daughter of Bryn Olivier, was most frank in discussing the relations of her mother and aunts with Brooke. Ms. Charlotte Dean was an indefatigable picture researcher, and Mr. Tim Freeborn of the Daily Mail's financial staff helped me compare Edwardian currency values with those of today. D.M. Thomas, poet, novelist, mentor and friend, showed me Brooke's grave on Skyros, and greatly encouraged me when this project was but a gleam in my eye. Andrew Roberts, a historian with a special knowledge of Edwardian England, was kind enough to read the manuscript. Lastly, it is no mere convention to thank my partner, Lally Freeborn. She lived the book with me, and, not least, reminded me to inquire into who cooked and cleaned for Rupert. I still don't know. Nigel Jones, 1999. Second edition. For this second edition, published by Head of Zeus, I am grateful to the late Paul Newman for supplying me with some of the details in connection with the death of Carr Arnold Forster, née Cox, and to Jake Arnold Forster for allowing me access to those family papers and photographs in his possession. Jane Winter, who is writing a biography of Carr and Will Arnold Forster, was also helpful, although she disputes that there was anything unnatural about Carr's death. Nigel Jones, 2014. Introduction. What's in a name? Rupert Brooke, isn't it a romantic name? Trilled Lytton Strachey to Virginia Woolf after meeting the brilliant and handsome young Cambridge freshman who was about to conquer the university, just as he had cut a swathe across the sacred sward of Rugby School's famous close. It takes a huge leap of the imagination for us, at the end of the century whose batting he opened, to imagine what the mere words Rupert Brooke conjured up for his contemporaries and the generations that followed his death en route to the blood-drenched beaches of Gallipoli. Those three syllables encapsulate a world, a timeless world of honeyed teas, cricket whites on greens, the rap of leather on willow, and the mild ripple of applause that follows. Punts languidly negotiating a riverbend where weeping willows lean, girls in gypsy headscarves and floppy-haired young men, a world where, except at rural camps, someone else was always there to cook and clean. A world of class distinctions, rotten teeth, and people who knew their place. But I find myself drifting into one of Brooke's list poems, in which, simply by ticking off material objects in which he took delight, he attempted to summon and sum up a world to defy time, change, decay, or, in one of his favourite words, transience. It is a measure of Brooke's success as a writer.